Welcome to another episode of the Unsolicited Opinion Metal Podcast. This is Wesley Negron, your host, and you just heard some with the track Animals from their great album, The Shape of Everything. And with me, I have the pleasure of having the writer, professor, and big-time progressive rock and metal fan, Jordan Blum, who is promoting his new book, On Track, Opeth, Every Album, Every Song. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Wesley. Thanks so much for having me on.
Of course. It's always exciting to have a conversation with people that know about Opeth. Anyone who has heard this podcast knows that Opeth is probably the band that I mentioned the most throughout all the episodes. So this is when we get down and nerdy about Opeth. Awesome. So before we get really into that conversation per se, let's talk about your background. Let's talk about, you've worked with music publications like Metal Injection, Prog Magazine, Consequence, Loudwire. Can you talk to us what really inspired you to become a music journalist?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, I guess, like a cliched answer maybe, but it was just kind of an adolescent love for the kind of music and writing. So my background's actually technically in like creative writing, like fiction and poetry. That's what my master's is in.
Nice.
So as a kid and as like a teenager, I loved creative writing and poetry and fiction and all that. And then as I was kind of developing an interest in that, I got exposed to all the classic 70s progressive stuff, like King Crimson and Yes and Genesis and Gentle Giant. So yeah, it was just basically kind of a merging of those two. And then once I got to college in 2005, I realized that they had a newspaper. And I said, all right, here's where I'm going to kind of really start putting these two things together and writing about the music that I love. And one of the first things I ever wrote kind of for them was a review of Ghost Reveries.
Nice. So
kind of was like where I started is kind of not where I'm ending because I'm certainly not done, but kind of where I'm at now, kind of all started all the way back then.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting, the timing of things. And what would you say right now would be among your biggest pieces or some of the stuff that really got you excited in general, like throughout your whole career, what has been one of the things that got you really excited?
Yeah, I would say the first time I ever interviewed Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull was certainly a huge moment for me because, you know, as I said, those albums were what started me was, you know, Thick as a Brick and A Passion Play, especially. So getting to interview him for the first time was kind of one of those moments where I said like, oh, you know, this is what I want to do. Like I'm kind of making it. Same with like Devin Townsend, I would say, and Stephen Wilson. Like those are some of the people that I've interviewed that I would say I was kind of starstruck and kind of just, it was one of those moments where you kind of take a step back and go like, I'm actually like doing this almost like an out of body experience.
Nice.
So getting to do that and getting to do some lists I've done recently for Loudwire is kind of like a dream come true kind of thing. When you chase the publication for a while, when you constantly kind of pitch them and say like, hey, you know, I'm not trying to be a pest, but I would really love to do something and kind of be a part of this. And then you finally get to it is, it's still kind of surreal for me. Despite all the negative feedback that those articles get in the comments section, that's just part of the job.
It is. It is. It's just a matter of ignoring those. Yeah,
exactly.
I understand the feeling. I had the opportunity to actually interview Martin Mendez last year, and he's my favorite bass player. I'm a bass player myself. He's my favorite bass player, yeah. And I was so nervous, but it was awesome. It was a great. We had a great talk about White Stones, which.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
He kind of reminds me of like John Mayong from Dream Theater, and that they both kind of. You don't think of them as like the biggest personalities for their bands, but they just, they kind of show up, they keep to themselves and they get the job done and they're incredible at what they do.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And being able to, like, you know, in case of Mendez, he's a Latino. I'm also a Latino. So being able to kind of share some point of views about the way that we create music was actually very interesting. So yeah. Being able to have these chances and talk to your idols and kind of share thoughts with them. It's something. It's very special for sure.
Yeah.
Awesome. So in talking about Jethro Tull, you were also the writer of On Track Jethro Tull and On Track Dream Theater. Can you tell us a bit about your experience writing those books compared to writing on track Opeth?
Yeah, for some reason, writing the Opeth one took the longest. It took about a year. And for some reason, it was just the hardest of the three to do. I don't know why. I think I was just busier. And I think part of it was that, and I'm sure, you know, every writer could relate to this, but I think I put more pressure on myself to write the Opeth one than the other two because of the three, they're the band I like the most. I love Dream right. Theater and Jethro Tull, but, you know, push comes to shove, gun to my head, Opeth is my favorite of the three.
Right.
So I definitely, not to say that I didn't put like a ton of effort into the last two, of course I did, but I think with this one, I was much more like focused on getting every sentence right and every idea right, and really just in the back of my mind saying like everything I'm saying about every song has to be exactly what I want to say about it. And I have to, you know, not that I care so much what other people think of opinions. Again, going back to what I was just saying, it's very much like, here's my book, here's my thoughts. If you disagree, you know, respectfully, let's talk about it. But if you get angry, then, you know, whatever. So those other two, I think, were kind of easier to write. They took less time. And in all three cases, it obviously just brings you a whole new level of appreciation for the catalog and all the changes that maybe as like a casual listener, you're aware of, but you kind of take them more for granted. You don't really like nitpick. Whereas this one, it's like, let's examine every album and how it's an evolution and how the influences kind of come in and leave maybe as it goes.
For sure. That's the most interesting thing about Opeth's career, in my opinion, where, you know, you have basically three different stages and three different, you know, styles of music in a sense. And you can just write and talk about all of them in depth, you know, and compared to what was happening in their personal lives or Michael's personal life by each era of the band. There's a lot of information to take out of there for sure.
Yeah, I think of the three, they're definitely the ones that have changed the most. Like, as you say, there's at least three different like phases of Opeth, whereas the other two, not to say they've repeated themselves necessarily, but they haven't changed as much, or at least not as like drastically as Opeth.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. And that's the thing. And particularly what has happened in the last, 12, 14 years with Opeth after they released Heritage, everything was because the change between, say, Still Live, My Arms, Your Hearse to actually Blackwater Park and all those classics, right? It seemed a little bit seamless because they were still heavy. They were still, you know, they still had that death metal thing on them. But then they went completely prog rock, no growls. I remember being angry at people for not like wanting more growls on their songs. Like, they have a complete back catalog with great songs that you just can't hear this. Respect their decisions, but you know. I think after a few years, Heritage has gotten way more respect than what initially did.
I mean, one of the things I love about Opeth too, and Akerfeld, and he's like on my bucket list of people to interview. I've interviewed Frederick. I think when Heritage came out, I interviewed Frederick, but I've never spoken to Michael, and that he's still like at the top of my list of wanting to. But one of the things I love about him and, you know, like Stephen Wilson from Porcupine Tree, who produced three Opeth albums, is that they don't care if fans like it or not. Like, as much as, you know, they do, they want to sell records, they don't want to make anybody mad. But Michael Akerfeld's always been outspoken of like, I'm the creative leader of the band. This is what I'm going to do next. This is what I have to do next. And if you follow me, you know, great. If not, then enjoy what I've done before. And, you know, I'm not going to change. And what you were saying before too is interesting because prior to writing the book, again, I didn't really like look at their catalog so closely. So I always kind of lumped in, I guess I always kind of thought like Orchid to My Arms, Your Hearse is one phase, and then Still Life to maybe Ghost Reveries is the second, and then Heritage to Inclawed and Venom is like the last. But I kind of see Still Life as like the fourth and final part of their first phase, and then maybe Blackwater Park is like the start of the second.
Yeah,
it's interesting how they kind of you can see it that way. Like, it's a very gradual evolution.
Yeah, I think so. Actually, I think because Still Life has a lot of black metal influence, and so even though it's not as you know, obvious as My Arms, but they still have that, and the production of that album as well, and they it also sounds way more angry than you know, Blackwater Park. On, I mean, we can talk about Deliverance as well, but and this it's very interesting because that's the thing about Opeth. There's so many things to talk about them and go in depth about it. So when you were doing your research and basically going through all the catalog and writing for the book, can you talk about how was the research conducted, and what was your overall routine and process to actually come up and write this book the way that you wanted to?
Well, for all three books, really, it's kind of been the same thing, which is for all three books, I've kind of had another book to rely on. So for this one, there was Rocket 88's The Book of Opeth that came out a few years ago, then it was revised within the last year or two. So I was actually contacted by the publisher to see if I wanted to review another book, and I kind of said no, but you know, I'm working on this book for this Sonic Bond series that's quite different from what you're doing. And that's the thing, is people, for all three books, people have written to me and said, hey, there's other books on these bands. And I'll say, yeah, but I'm not writing a biography. I'm writing a kind of different thing. Right. So for the Opeth book, I had The Book of Opeth that very much went album by album too, or at least like, you know, from beginning to end, about, you know, what they were doing with the albums and more of a biographical thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm very much kind of relied on that. And, you know, when I got to a new album for my book, I would read about that album in their book and kind of like underline things I wanted to bring into it. And then from there, it was just kind of literally Googling like Opeth band title or album title and seeing what popped up. I would always go to Wikipedia just to kind of get a general idea of what was going on. And I would always look at the sources and the citations and kind of see what citations led me to other sources. So I would say in general, for every album, every chapter, I would spend just a day kind of reading a lot of stuff and underlining things. And pretty much for everything I write, whenever I have to write an essay on something, I'll pretty much compile like 30 pages of sources and notes and read through and underline things and kind of find connections. And then I would take a piece of paper and outline what I want to talk about. So like introduction for Blackwater Park, make sure you talk about, you know, Still Life to Blackwater Park and label change and where do I want to go from there? Where do I want to go from there? So it was a very kind of formulaic approach. That was just a lot of like research mixed with my own knowledge and my own opinions.
Excellent. That sounds great. I wish I could write like that. I wish I was organized like that. I always have a mess and then somehow I just come up with the final piece. I mean, I've never written a book, but like whenever I write, you know, reviews and stuff like that, I'm not as organized, but that's a great way to go about it for sure. Talking about references and some of the stuff that's out there about Opeth, one of my favorite things and one of the things that really got me very educated about Opeth and their life and everything that they've gone through is the Spotify. Spotify has a podcast called This Is Metal or something like that. And they have a specific episode with Michael pretty much going through the whole life of Opeth since the beginning. Wow. And there's actually some point because this came out after, I think it was while they were promoting Pale Communion. And in the middle of the interview, Peter Lindgren comes in and joins and talks a little bit about the band with Michael. And it's always fun because you get to listen to a few things that, you know, I had some questions before about Michael's personal life and him like enjoying sports, for example. And he talks about him actually playing soccer when he was a kid. And you know, those little details are the things that me as a fan just get me even more excited about them, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's important, like it goes without saying, but one thing I'm sure you've noticed too is artists can tell when the interviewer is an actual fan or if they're just kind of hired to ask questions.
For sure.
So it's like, it's good to know that you actually like this band and I'm sure that gets, you know, it's more appreciative that way.
Yeah, for sure. And you can also understand, because obviously, you know, these are things that there are general things, but they also go really in depth about, like, for example, when he didn't have a place to live and he was living with Jonas from Catatonia, and how that influenced the overall making of the albums, that it, particularly Still Life and Blackwater Park, right? So it's very interesting to kind of correlate what was happening in his personal life and how they turn it over to create these great masterpieces, because, you know, I honestly don't think that there's a bad Opeth album.
No, me neither. And you even see, like, in the studio diaries that he would post on the website of how they, you know, they went from, yeah, like struggling to buy food and sleep and all, and kind of living in the studio to, you know, driving to a better studio. And it's just like the evolution of the production and the songwriting went along with the evolution of their personal lives.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I always found that, like, it's very admirable, actually, because, you know, actually being able to just go through it and release the records and then look at where they are right now. It's just amazing. So let me ask you, what would you say it's your favorite anecdote, or basically say maybe your favorite part from the book that you would like to share with everyone?
Oh, yeah. See, I'm trying to remember what it's one of the earlier albums. I can't remember exactly. I had the book in front of me, but for one of the albums, and maybe you would know, it's one of the earlier ones, is an anecdote of from Akerfeld where he was talking about recording vocals in the booth and they thought they heard a ghost. So I think it was either like My Arm, Still Life, or Blackwater Park. I think it was one of the first two where, like, they thought they heard a ghost, and it kind of spooked them and maybe got him more into character or something.
That maybe sounds like something from My Arms, actually.
I think it was My Arm.
I never heard this story before.
No, let me see.
That's interesting, because I know a little bit about the, for example, the Deliverance sessions, that they were not really happy with how everything came up. And ironically, that's my second favorite album. I just find that the rawness on that album and the way that, you know, there's some songs, like, for example, Wreath does sound like a little bit rushed and like, okay, we just have to finish the song and let's move to the next one. However, yeah. I think that incorporates a lot of really interesting things that just makes that album, right? So, but yeah, never heard about this ghost story before.
Yeah, I think it was My Arm, Your Hearse. And going back to what you just said, because, like, at the end of every one of these books, the author has to rank their favorite albums.
Okay.
And with the other two bands, and with most bands, it's really easy for me to say, yeah, this is their best, or this is my favorite. But because Opeth have such a such distinctive chapters in their sound, not to, like, be, like, hyperbolic or cliched or whatever, but it kind of reminds me of, like, the Beatles, and it's like, you know, what's your favorite era of the Beatles kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've always kind of had a four-way split between Still Life, Ghost Reveries, Damnation, and Pal Communion. And ultimately, I had to, like, organize them. But every day I go back and forth of, like, what do I think is my favorite of theirs? It depends on what I'm looking for.
That's very interesting that you added Pale Communion there.
Oh, I think Pale Communion is a masterpiece. I will defend that to my dying day. Pale Communion is a masterpiece.
It is a great
record. It's by far the best thing they've done of the four, like, jazz fusion albums, I think.
Interesting. I think I love Heritage. I remember getting a lot of hate because I liked that album. And that was actually the first tour I got to see them live, was on that tour. But I honestly think that with Incauta Venenum, they were able to kind of, quote unquote, perfect or make, you know, come with the last idea of what they want to do with this particular era. Like, this is the perfect blend of all that. I think that's Incauta Venenum. I love
certainly the darkest of them.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not really, and this is mainly because I don't really understand what they're saying. I'm not really into, like, they're playing these songs live and they're playing the Swedish versions. I've seen them. I think I've seen them three times since that album came out, and I'm not able to sing along to these songs. I want to sing along, but whatever. That's obviously part of who they are, and they're Swedish, so
But, talking about like the evolution, you know, it was a big deal for him to finally say, I'm going to sing in my native tongue.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And that's also very admirable as well, where, you know, they make two, basically one album in two languages. They both have the same impact as far as, you know, the overall, you know, reaction that people get from the music. It's that's something that's not really easy to do at all.
Yeah.
And they were able to pull it off. And, but yeah, I think Pelcomune is a great album. It's interesting because I feel that Sorceress is a little bit like a lot of people don't really give the credit that album deserves. And I agree. It's a great album as well. I mean, I'm a big fan. I would say if someone asked me what's the album that you don't like or that you would place last, I would say maybe Morning Rise. Mostly because Black Rose Immortal is there and it's way too long for me.
Yeah.
But Advent, for example, Advent is a great song and that's a great way of opening an album for sure.
And To Bid You Farewell, which is, you know,
yep,
kind of rudimentary, but it's far better than anything I could come up with. who am I to say?
Yeah. No, they're definitely, you know, it's, there's a lot to dissect. So what would you say is your favorite era then?
A favorite era?
Mm-hmm.
The middle era. Like in my ranking, I put Orchid and Morning Rise as the last places, just kind of by default, because as much as I'm into like the heaviness, it took me a long time to even get into the heaviness. Like I for a while was not into death vocals at all. Like I couldn't stand it, so it was kind of an acquired taste. So as soon as they got more progressive, I flocked to it more. So those are like my bottom two.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Also, like the Orchid still has a strong Iron Maiden influence. There's a lot of, you know, guitar harmonies are just like Iron Maiden's, and then they went completely black metal on Morning Rise, and then My Arms Your Hers has two of the best songs Opeth has ever done with When and April of the Real. Those two songs are on my top list. They're so great.
There's such an evolution from Morning Rise to Heritage of like the jazziness and the bass playing, and just like you really listen to My Arms Your Hers and it's, you know, it's rudimentary compared to where they would go. But I was listening to it the other day and I thought, like, even back then they had such melody, they had such like melodic qualities in the riffs. Yeah. Like what other metal band has such melody in their like crunchy guitar chords?
Yeah. And that's all from that, you know, that progressive background that Michael Akerfeld brings to the band.
Yeah.
I find it very interesting. Like, obviously we see that after, you know, from Still Life on, but that combination of having two guys from Uruguay playing the rhythm section with two Scandinavian dudes playing guitars. And it's like the cold with the warmth, you know, the cold from the Scandinavia with the warmth of South America. And that combination is just perfect, because I also think that there's a lot of anger from the two guys from Uruguay, from both Martins. And that kind of blends perfectly with what Michael and Peter wanted to bring with the band. And then you have, you know, really big riffs, chunky riffs on Still Life with these very tasty Latino almost rhythms. So
yeah,
having that combination of members from different places definitely brings a little bit of a different taste to the band as well, which I don't think by that point anyone else had. And I don't think anyone else has today.
Oh yeah. I mean, Opeth is one of those bands in general where I say like, they're the best at what they do. Like there's a lot of bands that go for that kind of like progressive death metal, folk metal. And there's bands that do it differently, but I feel like there's a lot of bands that try to emulate Opeth, but they're the best at it in the same way that, like, Love Them or Hate Them, Dream Theater is the best at what they do. Between the Buried and Me is the best at what they do. Like, you can try to rival Opeth, but I just, like, you don't have it. Like, they're the best at what they do.
Yeah, for sure. They set some standards, and to get there, it's going to be very hard. I have one more question about Opeth's era before we wrap this up. Martin Lopez or Axe?
Oh, Lopez, I think.
Why is that?
That period, that era with him is my favorite. And I just feel, nothing against Axe, but I don't feel like he's as distinctive as Lopez, especially like the end of Deliverance. Like,
yeah,
it's always fascinating. I mean, you have like, 4 or 5 minutes of just a repetitious like riff and a repetitious passage. But every time it circles back, he's adding new syncopation to it.
Yep.
And it's just, I wouldn't say it's subtle. I mean, everyone notices it, but it's just brilliant how he leads that whole like section. If he wasn't like innovating with every few measures, it would be, cool, but it'd be kind of boring, I think, by the end of it. So that alone to me puts him above. This kind of like one song, one example lets him win.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. You talk about that last part, Deliverance. I love the fact that he gradually adds more symbols to each, turnaround of the section. And then in the end, he just does the combination of all of them. And again, I've studied his patterns just to make sure that if I'm playing the song on my bass, yeah. I'm doing, the stuff or try to do the stuff that he does. I have a little bit of a fantasy that, it would be awesome to have Martin Lopez back in Opeth. But it would also be interesting to see him play some of the stuff that Axe did from Heritage on, because that's another thing. I wasn't really into Axe on Watershed, but then when he came up with Heritage, his drumming chops just came out of nowhere. He was just doing some really superb stuff that got me to like, okay, I should just start giving up on, Martin Lopez being in Opeth. That era is past. Now Axe is here. And yeah, it was definitely a huge surprise when they announced that he wasn't going to be in the band anymore. But yeah. I would also pick Lopez. I think he has that, again, that Latino flavor, but at the same time, he knows how to play death metal. And I'm pretty sure that if he would sit down and play any of the songs that they have released since he left the band, he would still be able to play them. And also the stuff that he's doing with Soen is really good. Mm-hmm. So, he's definitely someone to look after too as well. So,
yeah. Cool. And I mean, you have like the two of them, him and Mendez basically like joining at the same time and Mendez having to wait until Still Life to really make an appearance, but they were friends first. They played together first. So they, you kind of got them as a pair. And as much as like Mendez can work with any other drummer, I mean, that's the sign of being a competent musician is you can, work with people. I think you automatically kind of lose something in that rhythm section just because you kind of broke up the set. But the other side of that is like, who's to say it's not like Ackerfeldt's writing too? Like,
right.
That Axe is great for what he's done, but who's to say that if he were given more opportunities to shine in the ways that Lopez was, maybe he would have measured up or maybe he would have surpassed Lopez. Who's to say?
For sure. And maybe it also helped him, like Michael telling him like, hey, this is the direction that we're going to go in the next record. I need you to step it up. Yeah. I need you to get into these things. And like, and he showed up. He's also a professional musician. Axe is great. And also the stuff that he's doing or he did with Bloodbath is also amazing. So obviously, in order for you to play in Opeth, you have to know how to play. It's not going to be just anyone. So,
and not just like the technicals, metals. I mean, that's the thing with Opeth is there's so much more to them than just like quickness or intensity. I mean, even, Ackerfeldt said, who's to say what's heavy or what's not, or your definition of heavy may not need to be like volume. To be a great musician, you have to know when to scale back. You have to be adaptable. It's not all about like being the loudest in the room.
That's true. And I think that's the thing. Some of the performances that I've seen from Opeth, I'm a little bit proud of saying this. I've seen Opeth 16 times and they've never been in Puerto Rico. I've always traveled to see them. And I've seen basically, like that first show was the show that Michael has said that he made a mistake of not playing like the heavier songs. Mm. That tour was just, you know, clean vocals all the way. And you actually felt Axe being a little bit thrown back, but I've also seen, you know, I was at the Ghost Reveries anniversary show in New York, and that show was perfect because they played all of Ghost Reveries, but they also played some of the, you know, like they played, the Lotus Eater, which is a super heavy death metal song to a point where the blast beats and all the stuff. And obviously they also played Deliverance, and, you know, having all these songs and being able to admire or see someone that, you know, just making his songs, these songs his in his own way. And, you know, it still sounds great. So being able to be part of a band, like in that sense, it's definitely, you know, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to see who they get, you know, for the next album and whenever they decide that.
Yeah, I honestly, I'm going to pray. I hope it's Martin Lopez. I know the chances are very low, but if it's Martin Lopez, I am going to flip.
I mean, yeah, you never know. Like Haken just had, I think, two members come back. Mm-hmm. Never know.
Yeah, hope so. Hopefully. Let's see. We'll see. Hopefully that's something that they can work out. Mm-hmm. Either way, it's going to be someone that's going to be amazing. So awesome, Jordan. So can you please provide us all the info about the pre-sale, the release date of the book, any other crucial information that you want people to know about the book and how to get it?
Yeah, sure. So again, it's being published by Sonic Bond Publishing, which is a UK publisher. They have tons of on-track books, you know, if you're interested in other artists, but first buy mine, of course. And I believe it's coming out on February 24th in the UK and on April 29th in America. It's for sale through Burning Shed, as like the official distributor of Burning Shed, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I know it's been in Barnes & Noble stores. I've never seen it, but friends of mine in, you know, the Philadelphia, New Jersey area have seen it in the store. Those are the three main ways, I would say, to get it. I'm not sure if the publisher has a preference, but I would say those three ways: Burning Shed, Amazon, or Barnes & Noble. And if anybody wants to reach out to me on through email or social media or anything to ask me any questions about the book, I'd love to, you know, hear from you and answer any questions you have. Just if you do read it, let me know what you think of it. And thanks for the support.
Of course, I'm going to leave all the links in the episode notes. So make sure to check that out and pre-order the book. I'm actually going to pre-order mine as soon as we're done here. So. Oh, great. Thank you so much, Jordan. It was a pleasure having you. It was a pleasure talking about Opeth. I'm always open to talk about Opeth. And please, everyone out there, don't forget to order your copy of On Track Opeth, every album, every song, out on April 29th, US. And we can have an episode about Opeth without playing some Opeth. So this track was actually handpicked by Jordan. So Jordan, would you do the honors?
Sure. So next up is what I consider, and what many Opeth fans I'm sure consider, as the quintessential Opeth song, the kind of best representation of everything Opeth can do in one track, which is Ghost of Perdition, the opening track from their eighth album, 2005's Ghost Reveries. We'll be right back.
told she was the one who opened to the room and said you have to live before you die young. Shelf who told you was the one who opened to the room and said you had to live before you die young. Yeah. to see a beloved son in despair was to come.
Heard the Ghost of Perdition from Opeth. As mentioned before, make sure to visit the episode's links so you can order Jordan's new book on track, Opeth. Every album, every song. Now, a bit of stoner rock for all of you. This is Big Scenic Nowhere in the track, Murder Clip.
hands are holding dirty water. Once you're bleeding, you never stop. Standing nameless by the river, ride the rapids to the
Big Scenic Nowhere with the track Murder Clip from their album The Long Morrow, one of the best stoner rock albums released in January. We're staying in California for this next band. This is Def Club with the track New Voodoo. That was Def Club with the track New Voodoo from their album Productive Disruption. And we're about to reach the end of the episode, but first, I'd like to thank you for listening and your continued support. Next week, I'll be sharing my favorite general releases, and I can't wait to tell you all about the great music that's already coming out this year. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram under Unsolicited Opinion Metal Podcast. Now we go to Canada with Apes and their track No Will to Live, from their album Lullabies for Eternal Sleep. Thank you for listening. Have a great one.